The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. Individual tax matters should be discussed with your tax professional. Podcast of Clear Path Financial. Ryan Kittredge is here as always. And Ryan, thanks. Some great advice over these last few months about how people can either begin to save money, when they should be sort of in that ramp up period of 3 to 5 years. We were talking about the Roth IRA and is a conversion or when would a conversion be right? Let me ask you today as we get started. People are looking at their portfolio. And when you're younger and you have 40 years or whatever in the market, maybe a little bit of risk is good. When you're in this 3 to 5 year window we've kind of been talking about these last few months, when is it that you start saying maybe some of the stocks that I took a flyer on when I was younger, some have done probably very well, but geez, they're risky or they're riskier. How do I start to look at what is risky, what isn't? How should I balance things as I get older, particularly?
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Hank, for having me as usual. Great to be here. And that is one of the most common questions that clients first working with us tend to ask. It's, you know, some version of, hey, things have been going well in my 401k or, you know, in my investment portfolio, but I've kind of been letting it ride, right? I think, you know, it's done well, it's growing, but also, like, I know that the stock market's had a pretty good stretch, right? And it's fine to some degree to accept those downturns and losses when, you know, when they say that I have the paycheck coming in, I can kind of manage that a little bit, at least mentally, but what should that look like when I don't have the paycheck and the portfolio could be my paycheck? And it's a different conversation.
What are risky investments? Right now I'm hearing once again about if we're concerned about the stock market, make sure I've got some things in precious metals, whether it's gold or silver. But when we're talking about things that are risky, are we talking about particular markets like the emerging markets, Asian markets? What kinds of things we should be investing in? What would be considered some risky investment?
Risk is a bit of a subjective term, and I would argue that every type of investment has risk. It's just a version of kind of what flavor of risk is it, and is it concentrated risk, meaning, you know, everything in your portfolio is sort of going to go up and down in tandem, or are they calculated risks where they in combination have some diversification and, you know, lower correlation properties where it can balance things out. I think most people when they say risk, and I fall into this and sort of what I meant when I said it, is the volatility, is the price movement up and down, particularly down, right? People are okay if the price moves up quickly. They just don't like to see it on the other way. So oftentimes that drawdown or, you know, how much could I lose, how quickly, and will it interrupt my goals and my cash flow need or that ability to take a consistent paycheck or income from your portfolio? That's oftentimes, you know, what they're referring to. So overall, I mean, you have these kind of broad categories and you could say, well, stocks are riskier than bonds, which are riskier than cash, right? And there's metrics, there's a term called standard deviation, and that basically means how much price movement do you see, right? And so you might have something like the standard deviation of a diversified stock portfolio could be 17, a bond index fund could be 5, and cash could be basically 0. And then you get things like precious metals, right, which have diversifying characteristics. In and of themselves, they're fairly risky. Like the price moves around quite a bit. It just does so differently than that of stocks. So on kind of a pure, how much could it go up or down over a period of time? it's not that much less than, for instance, stocks, but because of how they correlate against each other, by having, call it 5 or 10% in precious metals, gold and silver, for instance, it can actually lower the risk of a stock-heavy portfolio, even though in and of itself, they're risky. It's kind of like, are the ingredients themselves, you know, spicy or mild? And then how does it all work together?
Well, I just remember, and I'm, you know, it's probably not good to, you know, use myself maybe as an example, but I mean, I remember 40 years ago, and you go to work for that company, and at the time, it was a company where you had a 401k, and then they were able to also match what you were going to put in. But they asked you, as you were putting your money away each month, now, are you risk adverse? Do you want to put money in some riskier stocks? Do you want to put it here? Do you want to put it there? And I suppose if you filled that out 40 years ago for your 401k, and now all of a sudden you're getting towards 65 and you haven't checked on it, you might want to reposition or reallocate some of that. How often are you checking that? Like every 3-5 years, every year? I mean, like when do you kind of start to move things around? And again, as we've been focused on these last few months, particularly as we head towards retirement.
The question of how often should you and how often do people typically, those can be different answers, and usually they are. I tend to see it be, at least for people in that accumulation phase where if they have that longer runway out, they don't need to be checking it all the time, but, you know, at least once a year, auditing your positions and the allocation, maybe twice a year. I tend to find that a high subset of people that, like, say they never check it and, like, they just head in the sand and they think it's going well enough. Or it tends to be on the opposite side where they're, you know, frantically checking it every day. And that may not lead to good decisions either.
Right, so right. Exactly, if you're a little too obsessive.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of the Goldilocks element. You know, it's interesting. So this study, there's just an article yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. I've got it here, so I won't make up the title. I'll say it. Americans' 401ks are more tied to stocks than ever. And they go in to explain, like, why that is, right? And part of it is individuals who are typically within a 401k plan, at least nowadays, but if you go back even 20 years ago, you basically were on your own and here are your choices and you had to pick them. Nowadays, you can still self-direct in your 401k, or you can use a sort of an investment objective fund, or a more commonly a target date fund, which basically picks a year that you're most likely to, you know, you're closest to age 65 based on your birthday, and that fund provider or, you know, 401k plan administrator chooses what they deem to be most appropriate, right? But each company's views of it are different, right? So Fidelity's target date funds are different risk level than Vanguard's, different than T. Rowe Price, and on and on. So what this study has found is that not only are individuals who are picking themselves heavier in stock allocations now, and I think that's fine for, you know, the 30-year-olds out there. But when they talk about 60-year-olds, basically saying that back, you know, just a decade ago or 15 years ago, it was, you know, the average person in their early 60s, so 60 to 64, kind of that pre-retirement window, they had under 50% allocated to stocks at one point, and now it's 60 some odd percent on average. And part of it is because if they did it themselves, and stocks have had a really good several year stretch of returns with, you know, with a couple bad ones in there, but overall it's been, you know, the upside has been pretty good. So if they didn't rebalance it on their own, they now have more heavier stock allocation just as a result of not rebalancing and letting that drift occur. I also find that people, you know, that are picking their own investments, they tend to look at, sure, you know, the name of the fund and, you know, some other things, but oftentimes their selection criteria relies heavily on what have been the trailing 3, 5, maybe 10 year returns, right? And so if you look at any fund lineup and a plan, the ones that have had the best 3 to 5 and 10 year returns are often the U.S. large growth funds. So things like T. Rowe Price Blue Chip Growth or Fidelity Contra Fund or, you know, S&P 500 Growth Index, in because those are funds that are concentrated heavily in the largest technology companies in this country, Facebook or Meta, Google, which is Alphabet, Amazon, you know, Apple, NVIDIA, Microsoft. I mean, that's what you're getting. And so by doing it on their own and you're like, well, of course I want the winning funds, I'm going to pick the ones that did the best. Oftentimes you get a portfolio that's pretty concentrated and you're sort of picking based on the past winners of the past several years, not necessarily what makes sense going forward or sort of averaging over time.
Yeah, that might tell you something about your tolerance for risk as well. I'm picking the ones that are these blue chips, or I'm picking the ones that historically do well. Others might want to gamble a little bit more, say, oh, I don't know, I saw whoever, you know, whichever talking head was on today when I flipped on the TV, and they gave me a hot tip, and I got to go in there. When people are looking, people tend to go, oh, the Dow is up or the Dow is down, and react to that. What should they be looking at if it's their 401k? And should they be looking at the S&P 500 or something different than just getting caught up in how is the Dow doing today?
Yeah. So there's the sort of the more academic answer from a financial planning standpoint, which I agree, you know, largely with, is that it really should be driven by your goals, which include your time horizon, when you'll need money, how much relative to what you have, and also your propensity for risk. And it's not even necessarily the ability, although someone's ability to withstand risk is important, but really their willingness to. And they are different because some people on paper, I say, hey, you could really ratchet up the risk. Your income needs are going to be met. And overall, this will result, you know, in better outcomes. But if they're like, well, that's great, although if things, you know, if my $1 million portfolio drops by 100 grand, I'm going to completely lose it, then that isn't going to work well. And so the other answer is what's worked out better than being a trend follower, which we all are to some degree, and the newsworthy things, right? And now it's Bitcoin and Ethereum and other cryptocurrencies. You know, there have been some other areas of the market, but the things that are in gold, right? I mean, like gold, no one was, you know, we've clients invested in gold for several years. 5 years ago, no one was really talking much about it. The last time I remember a lot of talk about it was after the great financial crisis, when stocks and real estate all capitulated and gold did really well. And then you heard all these gold advertisements 2008 through 2012, when everyone was still very, you know, reticent to step back into the market. That's what marketing does, is they always, and I would say kind of the Wall Street propaganda, they're always addressing the problems of yesterday and touting the things that worked in the rearview mirror, because they can say, look how great this did. Well, 2 years ago when, you know, it hadn't done well, they weren't talking about that. They were talking about something completely different. So you don't want to do that. It's really better, although it's difficult to do it consistently well, but to be a contrarian, right? And so a part of this study is basically kind of indicating that the fact is that it's easier to have a higher risk tolerance after a really good stretch in the market. Those downturns have been painful, but they've been short-lived in recent years, and they haven't blown up anybody's financial plan, you know, that I know, unless you took too much risk and then you sold out and then you didn't get back in and now you want to jump back into risk. Yes, that's like the worst thing you can do, right? But, you know, the better time to increase stock exposure is not like now, which people are, individuals are doing, like I said, because of the things that have done well and not wanting to miss out and all of that, but also the professional money managers. So this study shows that those target date allocations, even for the same age person with the same sort of stated time horizon, they're higher in stocks than they were. What XYZ fund company prescribes as the right allocation for a 60-year-old 10 or 20 years ago was much lower in stocks than it is today. And part of that, Hank, is they all want to keep their job. And when things are competitive and the market's still going higher, if they've had a more conservative posturing, they're lagging their peer groups, and their compensation, their job stability rides on that. So, which shouldn't be the driver of course, of those portfolio allocations, but that's the reality. So to answer your question, the better time to be opportunistic is when stocks are down, right? Is when things get pummeled. And so, you know, back after, for instance, like after, you know, early April, right? April 3rd was my birthday, and it was a, you know, 1,000-point down day on the Dow, and, you know, Trump had his posters with proposed tariffs, and then just it got worse from there, right? So after a couple weeks, things were beaten up. What I did, with some clients, that they like to be opportunistic, and they have dry powder that they keep in cash, and they want to wait for quote unquote blood on the streets, and then they want to scoop up and buy things, right? That's great. Those tend to be seasoned investors. They tend to be pretty savvy business people. They tend to have a pretty good stomach for downturns, and they're not the clients that are, you know, waiting for an up market and then it's like, boy, I really should be more in stocks. They're like, no, let's wait till the next black swan event, the next declaration of, you know, war threat, or the next, you know, tariff announcement comes through, and then we'll be opportunistic. I've had a number of clients that wanted to be and could be, you know, heavier and riskier, you know, higher growth assets. But what I've told them is, you know what, let's wait until those downturns, and whether it was the COVID sell-off or the interest rate hike, you know, of 2022, or, you know, going back further, all these different incidents, at those moments when the stock market's down 25%, I say, hey, you know, Hank, checking back with you, right? We wanted to be more aggressive. Yeah. How about we move in now? And oftentimes it's those clients that may not be as savvy or have as long of a track record personally investing their money. Then they're like, well, geez, well, not now, right? Well, not now. Things are terrible and they're only getting worse. And I'm like, exactly. That's what everybody thinks, right? That's the time to get in. Again, easier said than done. And I think it's a small subsect of people that can do that consistently.
Hindsight is always 20/20. We look back 6 months ago to that, you know, particular Liberation Day, and had you reacted as you were just saying, and some clearly did, boy, you're probably looking at some good gains here today. It's interesting too, though, that you have to have that dry powder, as you termed it. So you have to have something that you are able to spend with in that down mm-hmm. moment as well. And I'm also, you know, when you were talking about crypto, it kind of struck me, Ryan, as something that, you know, a few years ago probably was riskier, or people thought of as riskier mm-hmm. than maybe they do today. So mm-hmm. what you think of as being very risky can change.
It absolutely can. Yeah, the risk profile, the return and volatility characteristics of a certain asset class can evolve over time. Absolutely. And that's where I think, you know, in terms of ways to diversify, especially if it's in your 401k plan, you're limited to the plan choices within the plan, right? But it doesn't have to be, you know, the dry powder, quote unquote, you know, doesn't have to be idle cash. It can be using your stable value fund in your 401k or money market. It could be short-term bonds. It could be in conservative allocation funds that should, in most instances, hold up well, you know, not lose much, if not gain, during those other broader sell-offs. And that can give you an opportunity to rebalance without putting new money from your bank account into the account and buying. I mean, it could be that as well, but that's where that rebalancing helps. And if you have a mix that's appropriate, made up of different asset classes, then when one gets too far ahead and you see disproportionate gains, and now the skew is more toward those, you know, investments, take profits, buy into the stuff that, didn't do as well, that maybe lost money or didn't make much over that same period, it's counterintuitive. But if you do that consistently, you win, right? So it does work out. But again, it's a lot more kind of going back to that more strategic life planning type of profile. That's the stuff that really works. And it does matter about your retirement age and what other income sources are going to be there, right? So for instance, Hank, people tend to think, which, you know, is a good rule of thumb. There are a lot of great rules of thumb, but then they all have all these exceptions, right? So it's like, well, what can you glean from the rule of thumb and why is that true? But then what's different, right? So for instance, you get more conservative as you go on in time, right? And maybe when you're young, you're mostly all in stocks. And then when you're older, you've got more cash and bonds, and maybe you have only 40 to 60% in stocks, let's say. Fine, but there's also, especially for those that are retiring early, they haven't yet collected on a pension or Social Security. There's some evidence that, there's a lot of evidence that would suggest that approaching, say you're 52 and you're going to retire at 55, but have, call it 12 years before Social Security or 10 years before a pension, you may actually need to be more conservative in your mid-50s than you are later. And it's because of, well, what is that draw rate, right? Meaning, let's say somebody has, you know, they need $80,000 a year for income. And they've got $1 million saved, and then they're going to get $30,000 from Social Security, let's call it, right? Well, if they waited until 67, then they would need a 5% withdrawal rate kind of indefinitely. And it's fairly sustainable. So they might be able to be, you know, 60, 70% in stocks if they're comfortable with that, and have enough of a quote unquote, like a war chest of safe money that they can withdraw that wouldn't be down or down much during an extended economic downturn in a market, bear market, and it can get them through several years of that. But let's say it's that 55-year-old, they still need to replace $80,000 a year of income, but Social Security is not going to kick on for, you know, maybe a decade, right? So their withdrawal rate in that instance, if they need the 80, but those other sources aren't there, they need an 8% withdrawal rate, which over many decades is not generally sustainable, but to kind of bridge that gap, it may be. So we have some of those clients in those years leading up stashing away more in their after tax. In some cases, they're not maybe deferring as much, maxing out their 401k. Maybe they're favoring some, you know, bank high yield savings accounts. We're at that point maybe building it so that they're, you know, the safe portion of their portfolio, it could be 50% or better at that point. But then by the time their other income sources kick on, it's less of a withdrawal rate, they could actually increase. So we've had, you know, some clients that are early, you know, in retirement, they might be 50% in stocks, and several years later, they could be 70%. And it's all about, well, how many years of runway and safe withdrawals do you have so that you don't have to freak out? you may freak out a little bit, but you don't have to, you know, go back to work and be the Walmart greeter, you know, or whatever people say is their kind of their fallback, or make drastic changes in your portfolio that are reactionary and likely to hurt you long run.
It seems like a good place for us to end it. Is there maybe just something that sums it up, summarizes when we're talking today about how much risk, and particularly as you get older, how much risk you might want to be able to handle?
Yeah, I would say that there are different online assessments, and you can put your income needs and you can model out some basic things like that. But if you work with a CFP professional and they're doing that modeling, it is very customized, where people say, well, the average, you know, someone retiring, what should they have? Well, we have clients that have only 30% in stocks, and we have ones that have 90% in stocks, and it's equally appropriate but clearly different based on those income sources, their willingness and ability to accept risk, and a million other factors. So again, I think if you haven't already worked with a financial planner to come up with that retirement roadmap, then it's probably a good time to do that. And guess what? We do that. That's what we do. So we're here if you want to chat and talk about what our process looks like to kind of sketch that out.
Perfect time to tell people exactly how they should get in touch with you.
Our website, clearpathfinancialpartners.com. There's some resources there. We've got our podcast episodes up, just a bit about our firm, our history, client testimonials. You can get a sense of who we are. You can submit an inquiry and we're happy to chat with you and let you know if we might be the right fit or point you in the right direction if not.
Ryan Kittredge, thank you as always for giving us this information.
All right. Thank you, Hank. Appreciate it.
This is the podcast of Clearpath Financial Partners, clearpathfinancialpartners.com.